You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
All right. Hello, hello, listeners of CITR 101.9 FM. This is Randy, and you are tuned in to another episode of Dog-Eared Radio Book Club. Dog-Eared Radio Book Club is a biweekly book club coming to you through the airways of CITR 101.9 FM. I already said that it's biweekly. You can always reach me at my email for the show, dogearedbookclubradio@gmail.com, and then also find my Instagram at dogearedradiobookclub. All right, so this week we are talking about quite a very thick book. We're talking about Greenwood by Michael Christie. But first, I want to introduce my guests this week. Many of you will recognize them. I am joined this week by Cleo. You want to say hello to the listeners, Cleo?
Hi, listeners. I'm Cleo. For those of you that know me, I am the Indigenous Collective Lead at CITR, and I host Unceded Airwaves. And I'm joining Randy today via the telephone.
Yes.
That's where we're at.
Yeah, it's the 90s again, everyone.
Woohoo! There's a little crackle going. It's very, very fitting for the vibe of this book.
Yeah, it's very nostalgic, I have to say. I mean, not for me, but I guess for someone. But yeah, Cleo was nice enough to join me on the phone, which is so awesome. And also, I'm going to say, I think talking over the phone is interesting because I don't know if I've had a conversation like this with someone over the phone, like at least recording. I'm so used to doing it like face to face, but I also feel like face to face, it's almost like we're more scared to interrupt people. So then our conversations just end up being even more awkward. So I don't know. Maybe
like,
this will be good.
Over the phone, you can really hear like the cues and like the questions and the pushback of another person more intimately, kind of like when you're in studio with your headphones on. You're really listening to each other.
Yeah, that's actually so fair because I feel like it's because you're like right. It's more intimate than like to me. Zoom feels less intimate because the voice is kind of like detached from your face versus like because I can't even see your face. I'm just looking for like every cue through your voice. So I'm going to pay more attention, I think. not that I didn't already. But yes, huge shout out to Unceded Airwaves. Go check it out. But the book. Yes, the book. I don't even have a lead in because I just need to start talking about this book.
I'm so excited to hear about it. I read this book in 2020. I think I bought it like one of the first few weeks it was out. And I read it on my plane home during pandemic shutdown.
Wow.
Which felt very fitting for this book, honestly. When I read it, I was whoa, the world around you.
Yeah, no, this book is like, I was surprised. I guess I already said it, but the book that we're reading is Greenwood by Michael Christie. It came out in 2020, but I think it kind of like got more prolific and well-known this year. It was selected as one of the, it was on the long list for Canada Reads. Which I didn't know what that was until I looked it up, but it's basically like a TV show where these people, like, it's like Canadian comics and like journalists and stuff pick books and then they like debate them to choose like the ultimate Canadian Reads book or whatever. So this was one of them. So it's quite well known. But yeah, so I was actually surprised to learn that it came out in 2020, but it does make it feel even that much more eerie because, yeah, it's like talking about apocalypse and like death of trees and. Yeah, just like so many things. There's a lot of death in this book. Like a lot of death.
A lot of death. Well, it also covers 130 years, right from like 1908 to 2038. It has a lot of generational ongoing. So yeah, we come across a lot of death and a lot of like bad things happening to good people, but also bad things happening to bad people at times.
Yeah. And then people you're like not sure. I'm like, I don't know if you're bad or good, but I'm sad anyways. At least I was. Okay, well, let's because I'm I'm very eager to talk about this book, and I know you are. So let's start off with the segment where I read the description, and we'll do that, get that out of the way, and then we can actually dive into the vast contents of this book. This book is so long also. I did not research how long it was, and I just went into the bookstore and I was like, can I have a copy of Greenwood? And the person hands me this giant book, and I was like, this is it? Like, I have to read a 500-page book? What? It was worth it in the end. Yeah. Okay, so... Once again, have not practiced this, but it makes it all that much more entertaining. Okay. They come for the trees. It's 2038, and Jacinda, Jake Greenwood, is a storyteller and a liar. An overqualified tour guide babysitting ultra-rich ecotourists in one of the world's last remaining rainforests. No, just kidding, forest. It's 2008, and Liam Greenwood is a carpenter, sprawled on his back after a workplace fall and facing the possibility of his own death. It's 1974, and Willow Greenwood is just out of jail for one of her environmental protests, attempts at atonement for the sins of her father's once vast and rapacious timber empire. It's 1934, and Everett Greenwood is a Depression-era drifter who saves an abandoned infant only to find himself tangled up in the web of a crime, secrets, and betrayal that will cling to his family for decades. And throughout, there are trees, a steady, silent pulse thrumming beneath Christie's effortless sentences, working as a guiding metaphor for withering, weathering, and survival. Transporting, beautifully written and brilliantly structured like the nested growth rings of a tree, Greenwood reveals the knot of lies, omissions, and half-truths that exist at the root of every family's origin story. It is a magnificent novel of greed, sacrifice, love, and the ties that bind, and the hopeful, impossible task of growing toward the light. All right. So that's the description. Pretty dense, pretty hefty, I would say. But Cleo, yeah. I am curious. Do you think that is like a good, accurate description for the book?
Hearing it out loud, I would say yes. But it also kind of leaves out the biggest chunk of the book in the center, which I like because it's a surprise to find what's at the center of all the narrative and the storytelling. But I believe it does describe it quite well.
Mm-hmm. I would agree because I think, like, to me, this book is kind of part mystery because, like you said, it spans, like, 130 years. It's four generations of a family. And you're literally, like, finding out how this family was essentially, like, the conception of this family and then following the characters through their stories. So I feel like to not, like, give away all of the secrets, which, like, you know, is kind of the draw – I think it does a good job of like bringing you in, especially like reading it now after I've read the novel. I'm like, ooh, they were really hinting at stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's especially interesting because you do get introduction to the main characters and the main timelines you'll be interacting with in this book because it's kind of a lot. When I first picked it up, I was like, holy moly, that's a lot of timelines to juggle and to remember. Well, I'd be able to remember between all the jumps. How are they going to handle that?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And like, I mean, like you said, it does leave out because we get like this whole section of the book that's in 1908. But I do kind of like that because that section is what gets to you. Like that crushed me. I had to sit with that section for quite a while. And yeah, I kind of like that it was like a surprise, but it was still very like narratively necessary to have.
Right. And I find the way they tell it too is that It's really dense. It's a big book, but the book gives each character a moment to shine and the people around them to, like, for their story arcs and their lifetimes to make sense in this huge web of what is Greenwood and what the family of Greenwood is.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think that does. And I mean, obviously the trees, it does describe like the connection of trees because trees are truly like the backdrop of this entire novel. So I do think that part is quite accurate.
Yeah, trees are really important in exploring like the relationships between characters, but also between the characters and the world around them and what trees mean to them at their point in time and their point in the generational cycles and things.
Yeah. And also, like, you can tell, like, through the family, with each generation, kind of, like, the family's view of trees change. You know, like, Everett has this very, well, Everett, I mean, is in prison. Also, everyone that listens to this, spoilers, like, we're going to spoil the whole book. But Everett is in prison for, like, basically his, the bulk of his life. Well, I guess the second part of his life. But for him, like, trees growing up were, like, you know, a way to sustain himself, right? Like, him and his basically, you know, chosen brother created sort of this business to support themselves by, like, harvesting and selling firewood. And then, obviously, his brother Harris expands that to be this, like, great empire, which is what Willow comes into. So Willow takes this very, like, activist stance against, like, lumber, the process of getting lumber, which I can't,
what, clear cutting.
Thank you. Yeah, and takes a stance and becomes, like, an environmental activist. And then I think, like, Liam grows up in that environment with, like, you know, a sort of detached mom that's, like, very into this activism, and, like, he's not necessarily, like, he doesn't see himself as a priority. So I think that affects then his view of it. But then he also still kind of keeps that. So he creates a carpentry business where he uses reclaimed wood to create these beautiful things. But also he creates them for rich people. And then, you know, we get Jake, who, you know, takes a very scientific approach to almost the same type of, like, you know, environmentalist, like, fight against, like, clear cutting and deforestation that her grandma took, but in a different way. So I found that really interesting that, exactly, like, I think trees follow each character so heavily in this book, and that was really beautiful to read.
Yeah, like, even when you first open the book, the first page is literally a diagram or a picture of the rings of a tree, the age of a tree, and it maps out each year of our timeline in this book onto this tree. Mm-hmm. And at first when you see it, you're kind of like, oh, that's quirky and cute. But then you start reading it, and the progression of narrative starting in 2038 and working backwards to 2008, 1974, 1934, 1908, and then back out, mm-hmm. is like coming from the outside of the tree into the center to see where it all began and what the tree has seen, and then moving back out to what is going to happen to the characters after our little snapshot of them.
Yeah. Wow, I didn't even see that. Yeah, that is, yeah, I didn't even get that. Like, I realized that that's what it did. It started, like, in, you know, in 2038, and then it went, you know, yeah, to the past, and then it went back again. But yeah, I didn't even get that, wow, that really does, like, map out this story. That's so cool.
Right?
Yeah, I guess, okay, so we kind of already did this, but, like, initial reactions to this book. So for me, like you said, like, this book is, like, it's difficult at times. Like, there's some really sad, I don't know, I cried so much reading this book. I think I'm also just in a very, like, vulnerable state, I've realized. I'm graduating in, like, mm-hmm. a week. I mean, I graduated in, like, a month or whatever. I know, yeah. So, like, I'm facing this, like, really big change in my life, essentially, which is, like, I'm moving. And so I feel like I will admit, I'm not above admitting that I am pretty emotionally volatile a little bit. But this book is, like, the characters, because I think you spend so much time with the characters that some of them, at least some of them, you get to know so well. But yeah, it took me
especially a bit. When, like, some characters, you kind of, like, initially you're like, ooh, yikes.
Yeah.
But the more time you spend with them, you're like, you know what? I can sympathize and empathize with this person. They're not all one thing. They're so vast. And I think the book's length lets us get to know them really well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's why, like, it took me a bit to get into this book. Like, it was difficult for me to, like, get into it. And then, like, the last 300 pages, I just, like, blew through it. Once I hit that, like, 1908 section in the middle, I was like, oh my gosh, I just got to keep reading this. I don't want to do anything else. But yeah, no, that, like, that section specifically, like, reading about the history of the relationship between Everett and Harris, oh my goodness. Yeah, I'm going to talk about that later, because the character Everett to me is, like, the entire book. But yeah, no, exactly. Like, this interwoven stories and the characters were so real to me as the reader that, and I think that's just the beauty of, like, if you have a well-written character-led novel that's 500 pages, like, it feels like you know real humans. Like you almost, like mm-hmm. if you're reading it and the author does a good job, it's almost like you're like talking to a longtime friend, and like you get that to that level of empathy where you like feel it.
I totally agree. Like I definitely cried a couple times during this book, and even like when I reflect on it, because I've read it before and I kind of reread it a little bit this week for our phone call. But like sitting there and like getting to know those characters, I really sit there and I'm like, wow, it's like I'm listening to someone tell me their story. The same way like your grandma might sit you down and be like, I'm going to tell you all the family secrets now that you're an adult. Which is kind of when this book came into my life, when I was about 19, 20 years old, I was reading this and I was like, wow, I'm kind of at the phase where I'm starting to learn the family secrets. And this family has secrets and they have choices that don't affect the person that makes the choice, but their future generations, and the consequences come back around eventually.
Yeah. Yeah.
I definitely felt like this book was just, it is kind of hard to get into. I was intrigued by the like dystopian, futuristic tendency it took in the beginning. That's what really drew me in. I'm not a huge fan of historical fictions until I kind of started realizing, whoa, this is a really like, there's foreshadowing. And I know it means something. Let's see where it goes. And I had the same experience the last 200 pages flying through them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because at that point, your brain's like, all these things are lined up perfectly for an amazing ending or something that's going to change something going on here.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about the ending later, though.
Yeah, we'll talk about the ending at the end. but I definitely think the author, Michael, does a good job of, like, dropping like kind of hints and like clues. Like I didn't want to write in this book. I don't know why, but I didn't want to write in it. So I just like bookmarked things that I was like, oh, this is like an interesting part. But I kept bookmarking things that I felt like they were foreshadowing, in this case to like the past, which is really interesting also, right? Yeah, it made me think of the John Mulaney bit where he's talking about the movie, like creating the movie Back to the Future, and they're trying to name it. I don't know why it made me think of that, but I kept thinking of that bit. But yeah, no, the characters, yeah. And I think that's like, to me, that's like really interesting because I am drawn to like stories about choices and how like those choices impact you. And I think now especially I'm even more drawn to them because after, you know, taking a gender studies degree, you learn that like, you know, the idea of like choices, it's a very like neoliberal idea, the idea that we just get to choose mm-hmm. things without like any outside forces, there's no structures, when in reality like all of our choices are dictated by so many things outside of our control. And I think like, again, you can just read this book and enjoy it, but when you do apply that like critical lens, I think that also helps you to feel closer to the characters and to feel more empathy. Especially for like a character like Harris that, you know, initially would just be like a bad dude because he basically creates this like empire and destroys forests and destroys trees, right? And we can see him as kind of like this foreshadowing for the world ending because all of the trees die. But, you know, instead of just being like a one-dimensional, you know, villain, he is actually this like immensely complex person. That, yeah, we even get to know, which is interesting because he's not even one of, like, the main characters of the book. Yeah, so that was really good.
Right, and I definitely, like, with the historical fiction part, it was really interesting to read parts because it takes place across Canada, essentially. Like, at one point, you full-on go on a chase from, like, the east side to the west side of Canada, and you're mm-hmm. like, wow, things were going down, and, like, the accuracy, I kind of double checked on some things when I was reading things about like the early introduction of opioids and how there was a problem back in 1934 with Everett's storyline with opioids and being present, and then it reappearing in 2008 with Liam Greenwood. You mm-hmm. kind of see how these historical things fluctuate with the same fluctuations of the family and how the family's making wealth or how they're working for people with wealth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think Michael obviously did, like, an immense amount of research when he was writing this book because, mm-hmm. yeah, there's, like, a lot, yeah, like, the accuracy of everything, right? Like, the train, like, having this, like, a cross-country chase on a train and Yeah, like, oh, and even like it's interesting because a lot of it is based in Vancouver, right? Like, they're living on an island, which, like, you know, I think we're just supposed to, it's like an island off the coast of the mainland of Vancouver. And, but Jake, you know, went to the University of British Columbia. Like, I can't think of it. Willow was raised in this mansion in Shaughnessy, which I don't know. I used to live by Shaughnessy and there is a lot of mansions there. Like, so it's interesting. Yeah. Like this, it doesn't feel that far away, I guess is what I felt like reading this book. It didn't feel like something out of this world, even though, mm-hmm. you know, 2038, that, you know, it's entire fictional, but it still felt real in a very scary way.
Oh, an incredibly scary way. One of my takeaways from reading this book the first time was like, environmental anxiety kicked into overgear because I was like, oh my goodness, like this book like documented how we could have made a change during, say, Willow's lifetime and how mistakes were made during Everett and Harris's lifetime, and now Jake and people in our generation are gonna be stuck with the consequences. And I had a little midlife crisis at 20 reading this.
Yeah. Oh, I did too. I'm not going to lie. Like I was, I think that's why, like you said, you were drawn by the dystopian. I was turned off by the futuristic dystopian stuff. I don't handle like dystopian that stuff. I used to be able to read in high school. And like my whole analysis of that was before I realized how real these things are. And then I was like, I can't do this anymore. So I'm actually more drawn to historical fiction because I'm like, oh, that's in the past. So I can learn something from it, but I'm not going to like, I don't know. It's like I can kind of like separate it a little bit. But exactly, like it did. I went through the same thing. I was like freaking out. I was like, oh my gosh, all the trees died. Like, and I think my favorite thing about like the futuristic approach that he took is the weird things that Michael chose to like, that stayed in the dystopian future, right? So the world is basically ended. There's like no trees left. Everyone is dying because they're developing asthma because the world is dry. There's no water. There's no oxygen. So poverty is like constantly raising. People just keep dying off. But yet they still have student loans. I thought that was like a very clever thing because we all know that like student loans and capitalism will persist all, like they never go away. And then the Toronto Maple Leafs still exist. And I'm like, wow. So like people can't afford food, but the NHL still exists. Like what? That was so weird to me. But I thought that was
it felt very, very accurate though. When I kind of imagine what would that be now? 2023 to 2038, quick math, that's like what, 15 years?
That's exactly 15 years.
Oh, heck yeah. That's like not far off from what I see like my adult life looking like hopefully not with the complete environmental degradation and apocalypse, but in terms of the Maple Leafs and student loans being atrocious still and people taking jobs that are way below their educational pay grade and things like that. I'm like, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, the minimum wage will still be $15 in 2038.
Oh, goodness. Like Jake, even like they have a degree and they've gone to school specifically for plants and for forest, and they end up being pushed into a tour guide position at one of the last rainforests for rich people to get away and relax, which feels very fitting because even in like before Everett and Harris's lifetime, that was kind of the idea around a lot of environmental movements. It was like, yeah, we'll create nature preserves so that wealthy people from the cities can leave the gross cities and see nature for a bit and pay a lot of money and then leave, and becomes a commodity because they're commodifying the forest still, even when the whole world is going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and like the historical, again, the historical relation to like the future is that like, I had it. Theodore Roosevelt, like he's applauded to be this like great nature loving president of the United States, but he stole so much land from indigenous people in the U.S. and commodified it, created these national parks for people to go to, and then did it really poorly. They don't look after the land well at all. And it's led to all of these like increased forest fires and all of these problems where we're harming nature. Yeah.
And we see that even in 2038 with the great withering and how the entire world is kind of losing all its tree and biomass. And the one little spot we do have, when there's an issue, we hide it until we can deal with it later.
Yeah. Also, like, Jake has a PhD. Like, and what's like, wild literally. To me, so this, this is way too realistic. It's freaking me out. But, like, she got a PhD in this program and yet can't get a job. Why does the PhD program exist? Like, I'm sorry, this world has no trees left except for, like, very limited exclusive amount that are owned by private corporations that only exist, I guess, for rich tourists to go to. So, like, what is this creation of this program and then sending her out to just be broke and live in poverty her life? Because, I don't know. I feel like that's real. The university does that now. Like, there's no – because capitalism sucks and there's not jobs anymore. Anyways, I'm sorry. That went off into a bit of a rant, but –
But I totally agree because capitalism does suck, and it sucks for Everett and Harris. It ruined their relationship, essentially, when Harris chose corporation and money-making, where Everett wanted it for the joy of being around the wood and, like, doing things holistically.
Mm-hmm.
And capitalism got in the way the whole time.
Yeah, capitalism does suck. Yeah, maybe, you know what, let's take a quick break right now, and then when we come back, we'll dive into the characters. So listeners, don't go anywhere. We're going to take a couple minutes of a break, and then when we come back, we'll talk more about the characters.
Are you tired of Big Brother bookstores trying to sell you some billionaire's favorite book or Heather's top picks? Then you should check out Vancouver Books. Vancouver Books is a new online family-run bookstore. A portion of their profits go to First Nations reconciliation and environmental projects in British Columbia. They provide their customers with the most interesting books in fine arts, signed first editions, First Nations photography, fine ancient books, occult, and so much more. They also provide carbon-free delivery to anywhere in the Vancouver area. So go to www.vancouverbooks.ca to check out Vancouver Books today. That's www.vancouverbooks.ca.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
The milk is sour. I've barely been to college and I've been doubtful of all that I've dreamed of. The brink of my
second show added. MRG Live presents Haley Hendricks at the Biltmore Cabaret on April 19th. Haley Hendricks is a rising star in the indie folk scene. Her unique voice and intricate guitar playing will leave you spellbound. Don't miss the chance to see Haley Hendricks perform live at the Biltmore Cabaret. Tickets available at admitone.com.
This is a journey into sound.
Hi, this is DJ Wah, inviting you to join me every second Sunday at 8 p.m. here on 101.9 CITR for Techno Progressivo.
You in my head now. My life.
This is the house that funk built. This is the house that funk built.
Techno Progressivo is the only radio show in Vancouver where you'll hear the best mix of new tech house, techno, and progressive house.
A body bang. A
So join me every second Sunday at 8 p.m. for Techno Progressivo.
All right. Hello, listeners of CITR 101.9 FM. You are listening to Dog-Eared Radio Book Club, and I am the host of that show, Randy. I'm joined today by Cleo on the phone, which is really fun. And we are talking about the book Greenwood by Michael Christie. So before this, we were kind of just giving like overall thoughts, like feelings about the book. I do kind of want to dive more into characters now. So there's like a lot of characters in this book, which makes sense. It's like a 500-page book. But to me, these are like the main characters. So you obviously have the four main characters that are mentioned. You have Jack, who is living in 2038. You have Liam in 2008. You have Willow in 1974. And then you have Everett in, well, we get to see kind of him growing up from 1908 when I think he's about like 9 or 10 years old. Pardon?
About there, yeah.
Yeah. I'm estimating that he's born in, like, I don't know, around 1900. That's kind of what I'm thinking. And then in 1934 is, like, you know, the bulk of it. But then you also have Harris, which is Willow's father and also the brother of Everett. And then it's kind of like side characters, which I think play an important role. You have R.J. Holt, I believe is his name, and then Lomax. I'm not sure what his first name. And they're kind of more involved in like Everett's story. But then you have like so many side characters for like every timeline. Willow's kind of the only person that doesn't really have anyone else. And I guess, no, Liam does have, because Liam has a girlfriend, which is Jake's mom. Yeah. So anyways, lots of characters. I'm not, it's kind of hard like where to start, but I think initially for me, like I said, I wasn't super drawn into like the futuristic apocalyptic narrative, but I also just like right off the bat critique. I didn't think that the women characters in this book were as like well fleshed out. As you mentioned, well, we were talking about this during the ad break, but Temple, which is like owns this farm that Everett stays on for a little bit. I think she's really good. She's described, this kind of the description is like, this is a quote from the book, for the lady with the table on her porch. She basically has this farm in Saskatchewan, and she takes in a lot of like people that are considered like on the fringes of society that like no one cares about. So like back then, like sex workers, drifters, thieves, like people labeled as criminals, and basically creates this area where they can come and they can eat and then they can work on the farm. I think Willow and Jack, I'm not sure how to like describe this, I guess, but like for me, for example, I think Willow comes across as not a good mom. And like, I think I had to do a lot of work to give her my empathy and like understanding of like how she struggled to be a mom, whereas I think with the other characters, like they did such a good job of like laying out Everett's story and Harris's story and Liam's story. Like I was crying my eyes out by the time Liam died, like spending that one chapter with like that one section of the book with him, I was like, oh man, I don't want you to die, like this is so sad. Did you feel that similarly at all in the book?
For Jack and Willow, I found Willow to be a very aggravating character, mostly because she is an environmental activist who is kind of trying to fight the man, but even through Liam's perspective at one point when he's a child, he kind of describes it of being like, or reflecting as being a child and describing it as like, his mom was more concerned with the hippie lifestyle than actually saving the trees. But she makes like a big choice that kind of swings back around to Jake eventually, where Willow inherits a certain fortune at some point and then says, screw it, I'm going to give it to an environmental group to use this land instead. I'm going to get rid of it. I'm going to donate it somewhere else. And I was like, wow, a redeeming quality, but it was a redeeming action. And I felt that happened a lot through even the male characters having one big action that's the center of their narrative with all this other complexity around them. I did find Willow as a person to be aggravating, and her and it might have had a little bit to do with how her character was told.
Yeah.
Because she was always kind of not really based on her own choices except for those big ones and the smaller ones that Liam grows up to resent. And a lot of this book is about familial connection and how things are inherited and passed down through choices and actions. And Jake kind of doesn't really have that same relationship because her father was estranged, so she didn't have that big connection to the Greenwood name and the legacy of it all, but it still impacts her.
Yeah.
But yet she is also not a very big actor of her own choices or agency, because a lot of things just kind of happen to her, especially in the world she's in and how unfair it is to people in her position, which is like quite fair. Her position is very privileged compared to all the other people in the world she's living in, getting to serve capitalism in the peacefulness of a forest.
Yeah.
But as like the two main feminine characters in this story, I do agree they were a little underdeveloped, but I think that was also, or could have been, an intention of the author.
Mm-hmm.
Who also, in terms of ecological targeting and discrimination, women are very much at the bottom of the barrel, as we see a lot in oppressive systems. Yeah. And I think that plays into another reason why they have such a different position compared to the men in their lineage and in their stories.
Yeah.
Where you see the men are typically like, oh, this is a resource that I can use to, for one, like feed myself and my family, or to provide for the future of my children, or to make hella money on, let's be honest, because that's also a big ploy of part of the storyline.
Yeah.
Where the women are the ones that are resenting of it, because they're like, I'm not benefiting from this. This hasn't, like, made my life better.
Yeah.
Where Jake and Willow have different positions, but they're kind of a mirror of each other at times. I found that interesting.
Yeah. I also think, to me, I found, this is some kind of a relationship that I drew to, is, like, between Willow and Temple, because Temple, like I said, she creates this farm, which basically is, like, community action. Like, she's creating a community for people that have been kicked out and considered on, like, the fringes of society during, like, the 1930s. And even today, right? We have the same issues we had in the 1930s today. And so I think, for me, like, I kind of drew this connection between their approaches to activism and kind of, like, what Liam describes. Like, there is points where I think Willow comes across as, like, like, I was raised rich and privileged and I hated it because my dad destroys, like, you know, forests and stuff. But it comes across as very kind of, like, almost selfish. Like, she's trying to, like, redeem herself a little bit. And you see that because a lot of the things she does is alone. She doesn't do a lot of things with a community. Like, she mentions that for a time she lives with, like, an environmental organization in this house in Vancouver and does work with them. But she tends to do a lot of, like, independent actions. Like, she wrecks equipment. Like, she pours sugar in gas tanks. She does stuff like that. Whereas I think it's interesting because Temple takes this approach of, like, kind of, like, frontline, you know, work, what we consider, like, in social justice, right? Like, she's right at the front of it. She's helping people and, like, creating a community almost. And she does it through creating this library of, like, all of these books from all these people that she's met. And, yeah, like, not to make the argument she's perfect, because she is, like, technically, you know, people come there to, like, live and then they work for her to get food. So it's still, like, the same type of system. I don't know. I did feel like I think it was written in a way that was interesting to, like, draw, you know, parallels and connections between all of the, like, women characters in this book.
Yeah, I definitely feel, because this book focuses a lot on, like, generational relationships,
mm-hmm.
and women play a big part, especially when we're thinking of lineage. You typically think you go through, like, the men's line, and it's Greenwood, the last name, it does follow through, like, the man's lineage. But it does change with Temple, too, where Temple's born with Greenwood. I believe that she changes her name and things, and that's why her son... Oh, what's her son's name again? Please remind me. Liam? Liam's also a Greenwood, but takes his last name as opposed to taking on his father's last name, which continues the Greenwood line and things. I found it was interesting that
mm-hmm.
Willow is also the person that changes the patriarchal or the patrilineal descent of mm-hmm. the Greenwood name and legacy, what comes with it, which carries on to Jake eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. And we don't really, it's kind of just hinted at the ending. At the end of the day, all the characters in this book were really interesting to read. I would be curious to read it again in, like, a year with, like, that idea that you mentioned, that it's, like, intentional, because the ways in which, like, women are harmed by, like, these systems that we're talking about, like, capitalism and, like, climate change and all of these things. And obviously this book doesn't really bring in any sort of racial aspect either. It doesn't talk about like the immense connection, even on like it brings in a little bit of poverty. We have the historical like historical lens of the story of Everett and Harris. But yeah, I do think that is, I don't know. I think I'm also, I will admit that sometimes I am very brutal when I read books written by men and I tend to like really like judge them. But overall, I was very impressed with the character development of these. Okay, now that we mentioned that, let's talk about Everett, because I feel like I said, I think, I don't know if I said this in the episode or not, but I think Everett is this entire book. I think this book would be nothing without, like, Everett. Like, he's kind of in the background of every single story and kind of at the forefront. The only person that doesn't really talk about him is Jake, but that's because Jake doesn't really know that much about, like, her family. But, yeah, this man killed me. I was so sad. Like, I don't know. I just feel like there was, like, at the beginning, I was kind of like, whoa, like, why does this guy go to jail for that long? Because he's in prison for over 30 years. You know, and then we get kind of, like, hints, like, when he first meets Willow, except it's not the first time he's met Willow, but Willow doesn't remember knowing him. And he has, like, this nickname for her, and we're kind of, like, a little confused, so we're trying to, like, figure out, like, oh, like, what is his connection? Like, he's Harris's brother. And anyways, like, it just, like, I don't know. I felt like it was, like, a lot of, like, good hints were given that really, like, drew me in. But, yeah, obviously we do see the most of him in the 1934. So this is basically when he does find the infant abandoned, which, spoiler alert, it's Willow. And he essentially takes this infant, and at first he's trying to get rid of it. And I say it because he literally, for the first, like, however long, he just calls it an it. He's like, I gotta take it. And I'm just like, I don't know. It was hard to read, but it also felt kind of realistic for a guy in 1934 that went to war and obviously suffers PTSD, among other things. And so, yeah, he cares for this child and ends up taking Willow across the country to escape basically the cops, because he ends up beating someone else to protect the child. And then also the child technically is the biological child of Holt, which is like this other rich dude that we don't like in Ontario. And or no, I guess in New Brunswick. That's what it is. I had to look
New
it
Brunswick,
up.
I believe.
Yeah, I had to look it up. Anyways, so he takes his child across and ends up getting captured. And he basically lies and says he kills the child to protect Willow so that she can live what he hopes will be a better life with his brother Harris, and ends up going to prison for basically the majority of Willow's life. Yeah, I'm sorry, I was trying to make that like simple, and then as I like kept talking, I was like, oh my gosh, this is so complicated, because this is like 100 pages of text.
It's definitely really complicated, and all that goes down in between Everett and Willow's relationship for the first, I think it was like a couple months they spent together, at least a good like few weeks that they were together. But really, it is strange how he first interacts with Everett, of him being this older guy. He's kind of like a little awkward, but like he has something going on. He has these memories that Willow doesn't.
Yeah.
And that kind of follows through that when we do see Everett's whole journey with Willow and the commitment he had to serve out those 30 years to keep her safe in what he thought was the best way possible. It was kind of wild. And at first, Everett, when he's introduced, I was like, eh, I'm a little sus. Like, he kind of seems like a bum.
Yeah.
But then you kind of see him as a like the person he is and, like, the integrity that he has. Oh, there was a really interesting quote in this book. I don't think I had it written down anywhere, but it had something to do with the fact that integrity is a privilege that not many people realize that they can have, and that money allows you to hold your integrity higher, because when you're in poverty, you'll actually see what you have to do to survive and to keep yourself safe. And it has nothing to do with your integrity. It has everything to do with survival. And I find that Everett really shows that, because he's as a person, he is a good person. He has good intentions,
mm-hmm.
but his life took certain turns that were out of his control, but he still was able to do what he considers a very good thing for another human being Willow.
Yeah. Well, and also, like, when you mentioned earlier in the episode that, like, each character has, like, one redeeming quality, I think what's so, like, drawing, like, what draws me to Everett is that he has so, like, multiple, like, he does a lot of things that are just good. Like, he does them with good intentions, and it kind of starts, I mean, as a child, right? So, again, we go back to that 1908 part, which I will warn anyone who's going to read this book, even if you're, like, listening to the whole thing and we spoil everything, still go read it because it's still, it's a great book. And maybe you've stopped listening, which, cool, go read it and then come back. But either way, prepare yourself for the 1908 section because it kind of comes out of nowhere. But basically what ends up happening is it's the lead up, obviously, to World War One. And so Harris decides that he is going to go fight in the war. There's obviously a lot of, like, context that goes up to this. I also love how the 1908 section is told because it's told by this, like, outsider that's, like, telling the story to you. And it just feels so personal. And it drew me in so well. But anyways, Harris decides he's going to go sign up to fight, but then he starts to lose his eyesight. But because it's 1910, whatever, they can't prove it, so he'll just look like he's lying. So he's kind of stuck in this choice of, like, what he does, because if he goes to fight, then he will inevitably be, like, he's going blind, so he won't be able to see. And so, essentially what happens is Everett goes for him and lies and says that he's Harris, and he goes to war for Harris. Harris finds out, he's very upset, and so he kind of starts out on creating this, like, empire, you know, expanding this, like, I guess, like, clear-cutting and, like, wood manufacturing empire, and he's gonna share it with Everett when he gets back. And then Everett doesn't come back in time. This is the part that I bawled at when he, like, arranged mm-hmm. that party for Everett, and he made, I'm going to start crying in the studio, like, he made a plate, and they describe Harris making this plate and setting it to the side for Everett, and then Everett doesn't show up. And then a few years later, when Everett does come, Harris is gone. And mm-hmm. oh my gosh, like, it's so beautifully written, but it's so tragic and it's so sad because, I don't know, just that, like, action of, you know, Everett wanting to protect his brother is just so, I don't know, it's kind of heroic in this book. Like, it truly is.
Yeah, it really was tragic, and I definitely cried when he didn't show up, and I cried even harder when he did show up so much later.
I missed it.
Yeah. And then Harris was mad. And, like, you know, be mad, be petty, but, like, Everett went through a lot in the war, and he wasn't ready to come home yet.
Yeah, and he, like, says, like, later when they, like, meet up as adults, he's like, I couldn't get back to you in time. Like, it was not, like, a reason given, really, but he's like, I couldn't make it back. And, yeah, that just, like, because, again, like, you know, we don't get really Harris's perspective of, like, why did he need to become, you know, an empire? And obviously there's lots of reasons we could, like, put onto him, but I don't want to do that. But I think what's interesting is, like, at the end of the day, he sort of did make the choice to leave and create an empire versus, like, sustaining himself and staying for his brother to come back and creating a life with his brother. And I think, to me, at the end of the day, that's what was so heartbreaking. The scene where he made the plate, yes, I cried at that, but I agree with you, Cleo. I bawled, like, fat tears rolling down my face in the middle of my apartment. Thank goodness my roommate wasn't home. It was very kind of embarrassing. But, like, I bawled because he comes back expecting his brother to be there and care for him, and he's gone. He's literally on the other side of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And if it was hard enough to go home as it was, now it's impossible to go to where his home went.
Mm-hmm.
That really is what it is, right? It's like they were each other's, like, homes their entire adolescence.
Yeah.
And jumping back to what you said about the way that this 1908 section is told, it's like a chorus of people telling you, like, this is the lore of these children yeah. and where they come from, how they became adults, what happened to them, and why we don't see them. This is what happened. And it felt very fitting in terms of, like, looking back in history. And it's like, yeah, like, there are certain parts that can be verified by newspapers and documents and, like, photos and, like, stories passed down. But then there's parts that are just like, we don't talk about those secrets. But everyone around us witnessed it, and they remember pieces. And that's what we're going to tell you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very compelling, but so incredibly sad, because you get, like, a whole, like, almost essentially the whole lifetime that those boys share together until the moment that they didn't share it anymore.
Yeah.
Told to you in, like, 100 or so pages.
Yeah.
And you sit there, and afterwards you're like, whoa, that was... That put Shakespeare to shame a little bit.
I honestly...
I never had that much reaction to something that tragic, because it's, like, the familial platonic love between these two that really,
yeah.
really hurt and, like, touched a tender part of me. And I was like, oh, no.
Yeah.
I'm going to be sad about this for a long time.
Yeah, I cried. I cried when I read it. And then I cried when I had to watch Bridge to Terabithia for Jeff's show after. And then I cried when I was writing the script for this episode. And I was like, Randy, stop thinking about it. Stop crying. But yeah, I will say to listeners, I'm not going to read the whole page, number one, because I will start crying. And number two, it's kind of long. But during the 1908 section, there's this one chapter, and it's literally just a page, but the title is Private Greenwood. And this is basically telling us that Everett went to war for Harris. And just the way it's told, like Cleo said, like from this like group, this town is essentially telling us the lore. It just, oh, it gets to you. It gets right in your little heart, and it just gets in there. It's so good. The next thing I kind of want to talk about, which you already gestured towards, like in this 1908, we get this, you know, kind of town telling the lore, and part of that is telling the name. And I think that's something this book also does. Like you said, like, you know, it's this familiar connections, and part of that is names. Like how names are created. And so I want to find, you can hear me flipping through my book, because I want to find this quote that talks about the creation of basically the Greenwood name. And so I'll read it. So this is from page 220. And this is in, actually, I don't know what chapter this is, but page 220. Quote, "So this is how it came to be that instead of what we'd previously called them, either those poor boys or those goddamned boys, depending on what they'd done that week, the pair came to be known as the Greenwood Boys," end quote. And I thought that was really interesting, because I think it's like a little detail that like lends itself to this entire story, right? Because the book is obviously called Greenwood. The book is about this Greenwood family and the legacy of the choices of the members of this family. Yeah, and so I really like that detail. And then we also get, like, a naming. When Willow names her child, she names him Liam, which we find out kind of, well, the naming comes after we know the character, but this is named after her father's lover. And he records these records of him reading poetry so Harris, who is blind, can listen to his voice whenever he wants to. Yeah, so I thought that was, like, a really beautiful detail in the book.
I agree. And one of my embarrassing things about this book is that I really did not like Harris until I found out that he was a little fruity.
Yeah, that's fair. But see, that's the thing.
I was so frustrated with him.
Yeah.
I was so incredibly frustrated. And then I kind of saw more into his side and how he had to run things because of who he was and how one slip up and... during his time and his lifetime, being gay was not okay.
Yeah.
And I kind of understood some of his choices a little better, especially as a blind gay man. And I was like, yeah, that'd be kind of tough in that time. But at least he got a foothold and did something with it. But it led to a lot of other really big things for other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I also cried during Harris and Liam, his lovers, of, like, their lifetime together and what happened during yeah. their time together. Oh, I could have read a whole series on just them at one point.
Yeah, and I think, like, for me, it's not, you know, like, when we talked about Everett, like, you know, I would label him as a good person. Like, he does so many things that are generally good. But I think for me, like, Harris's story, it's not about good or bad, because I don't think he fits either of those labels. And I think for me, like, reading it, it just led, like, it, I had more empathy towards him because, like you said, more understanding about why he might have made those choices, again, because of the systems he was functioning in. But it doesn't excuse the damage that he did and, like, the role he played at the end of the day, and, like, how he affected Willow's life, right? Just like the choices Willow made, she directly impacted Jake's life, but also Liam's life, right? Speaking of relationships, I also cried when Liam made that violin for, I forget her name, but the woman that he was dating at the time, who is Jake's mom. I cried. I was, and not even in the way that, like, I was mad at her because she broke up with him. Like, I get why they broke up, because he was, like, pretty, he was going through a lot of things that he needed a lot of help with. But just, oh, I don't know. It was just so sad. Like, it was sad on both parts, I guess.
It's a book full of tragedies, and a lifetime is full of those, right?
Yeah.
I also, reading about 1908 and the beginning of Everett and Harris, and understanding that they didn't have parents and they kind of raised each other and themselves at the same time, made a lot of sense why each generation was so dysfunctional and had all these flaws to them and had trouble making those relationships with others. In the way that Willow couldn't form connections and make a community-based environmental approach in her in her efforts, and she did it all independently and alone and kind of self-destructively. You see that in Everett and Harris and how they go about certain things, because they just don't have the other influences and reference points for themselves. And it carries down the line, the intergenerational loss of communication and being able to express certain things to each other. And Liam and his partner at the time in the violin, I was like, there's so much loss in these people's lives. And it made me so sad.
Yeah. No, and I think that's why, like, again, cried at the end of Liam's chapter. The whole, I guess my summary of this book is that I cried a lot. but, like, crying at the end of it, like, same, like, very similar to Harris. When I first met him, I was kind of like, what are you? Like, why would I feel anything for you? Like, you're nothing. I feel empathy for every human, but you know what I mean? Like, in the book, like, he wasn't that, like, you know, engaging in the beginning. And then when you get that, like, one section of him literally contemplating his death, which, yeah, please be warned before you go read this book. But no, like, it, because his story is so full of tragedy. Like, he never met his daughter. Like, he had this very complex and complicated relationship with his mother. He didn't know his grandpa, and he, you know, his feelings toward this family and this name that, yeah, like, just, and, you know, this person that he loved, who ultimately they couldn't make their relationship work. It didn't work between them. But yeah, no, like, his story is truly tragic. And I think that is, yeah, it was hard.
Yeah, it's a hard book, but it's definitely worth it. The same way that, like Liam shapes wood into, like, beautiful pieces of art and, like, display and function. That's what they were all kind of trying to do, was make their life work with what they had going on. I deeply appreciate this book, and it was very emotionally resonant with me. And I believe anyone that reads it will probably have some sort of, like, takeaway or connection to it in some wildly complex way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think with this many characters that are so well-rounded and developed, I mean, for me personally, like, this made me, like, as a settler in Canada, you know, the story of your family, it's, you know, what secrets are, basically, at the end of this, I was like, what is the drama in my family? Like, I know some of it, but I'm like, I need to go home and demand that my dad tell me all of the secrets that he knows about the family. because truly, like, they do, right? Like, the choices that your ancestors made impact life today. Yeah, and I feel like, yeah, when you read this book, it will resonate in some way. Very quickly, I do want to talk about the end, because why is the ending like that? Tell me, Cleo, why is the ending like that? Why did it leave me feeling like I want to rip my hair out?
I honestly don't know how to answer it, but I had a thinking about it.
Okay.
I have a thought.
Tell me your thought.
That I had is that the very first page, we see the rings of a tree, and we see the life of the tree, and the tree is the Greenwood family, from where it started to where we're at, which ends with Jake. And Jake gets some big news that reconnects her to the Greenwood family legacy, and it makes things that go on around her make more sense.
Right.
And it gives her potential to change things. But how can you see the rings of a tree if not after it's cut down?
Whoa.
And I feel like that's why the ending of the book feels so weird.
Yeah.
Because when you cut down a tree, it's weird because you're ending the tree's life, but it's going on to do something else. And I don't know if that answers your question, but that's how my brain goes. I think that the ending of the book left such a weird feeling in the pit of my stomach and in my shoulders.
Yeah.
I felt it very viscerally of like, I don't really know where this is going to go. And it just did not end on a bright, happy, we're going to save the forest note. It ended on a really realistic, tragic, like,
yeah,
I guess this is where we're at now.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends there.
Yeah.
So that can like leave you to have like so many wild imaginations and assumptions of what will come next, what will transpire. But it's also in 2038. We don't know what's going to happen. The author might, but I don't think this book has a continuation. This is a standalone like narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But my hope with that symbolism of cutting a tree down to see the rings is that Jake will make some choices to do something different with what has already gone down and change the trajectory of where this tree will be and where the Greenwood family name will eventually be and what influence it will have.
Yeah. Well, and I think we do get a gesture to that when she talks about like the little girl that she meets, or I guess child.
Yeah.
I don't know if we, yeah. The child that she meets and like the thought path that she has of this child, becoming a part of this Greenwood family and what that would mean and like what the future would hold. And like, so we do definitely get like a gesture towards that, but I feel like that is like a beautiful, again, like you really brought in this like beautiful view of it, whereas mine was just like very heavy and kind of nihilistic and almost, I mean, my first reaction was like, wow, that was selfish. But then how is she going to save the entire world? Like, that's not, you know, that's a lot to put on one person.
Like, we think back to her grandmother, Willow. There was a really good quote that she often said, like, all the time. And I think it was, like, an old Chinese proverb. Let's see. Yeah, I have it written down.
Oh, okay.
Where Willow, the OG hippie, the grandmother, had said that the best time to plant a tree is always 20 years ago, and the second best time is always now. And I feel like that carries on to Jake, where she's like, 20 years ago would have been so much better for this to have been known and to have been in action and done in a way that made more sense. But I guess, like, there's no better time than right now.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, Willow, once again, had the moments of saying how, why is it that our children are responsible for the destruction we are now responsible for, in so many words?
Yeah.
And I think that you see, like, although we had talked a little bit about how the feminine characters of the Greenwood family were a little underdeveloped, they had the most, like, theoretically impactful part of the story for me was the feminine characters and what they said and did and how they navigate the choices that everyone else makes around them.
Yeah.
And you're right, like, Jake is one person who is already struggling and doesn't really have a voice despite having a doctorate degree.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I do, yeah, I like that view. I think that, to me, that gives me, like, a more, and, like, also at the end of the day, like, how do you end a book like this? Like, you just took me on quite a journey. How, you're just gonna stop? But that's how I get, like, with every book that's, like, really good. Like, when I read a good book that, like, draws me in, I'm like, how are you stopping this? Like, I don't know what you're gonna, how are you gonna end this? Like, you've built this into this ultimate great story. You've taken me through and I met all these characters. How are you just going to rip that away from me? Like, so I feel like no matter what, it would have been hard. But Yeah. No. I will be nicer about the ending. I think that's what I learned. But no, at the end of the day, this book was, yeah, I don't even know if I have like a word to describe this book. Yeah, it's alive. Actually, wait, that's a good one. This book is alive. It feels very...
It's alive.
Yeah, it's alive.
I'm not sure what copy of the book you have, but my copy has like, I don't know what they're called, like the page edges on the side of like, the opposite of the spine. There is the tree rings like printed on it. It really genuinely feels alive the same way that like even after you've read it and you might hate it or love it or feel resentful towards it but nostalgic with it, it's alive the same way a tree stump is alive.
Yeah
You might cut it down, but the roots still run deep and they're still part of the whole ecosystem around it.
Exactly. That's a great, I think that's a perfect way to end it. Yeah, definitely go read this book. Like I said, even if we spoiled everything, which we did, so I'm sorry if you weren't ready.
The order was off. It's okay. It'll still be a new experience when you read it.
Yeah. Also, I don't know if we, like, got to everything. And also, like, even how you find out things that we even just, like, dropped, the way that you find them out. Like I said, that private Greenwood, if I ever need to cry, that's what I'm going to go do. I'm just going to go read that private Greenwood page and I will start crying. If I was an actor, that's what I would do. That would be like my cry trigger. This book is great. And also thank you, Cleo, because this is like exactly what I had in mind when I came up with this historical legacies theme for this season. I feel like you hit the nail right on the head.
Yeah, we had mentioned historical theme and family and intergenerational relationships. I was like, I know just the book you need. When I read this book, I was a little overwhelmed, but once I got into it, it all made sense. It made my brain feel so meta going through the book.
Truly, truly, yeah. No kidding. All right, well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Dog Ear Radio Book Club. I'm back. Cleo is not, unfortunately. I'll be back in 2 weeks on April 25th, and I will be joined by Isia, and we are going to read Tar Baby. Well, we're going to have read it, but we're going to talk about it. So we're going to talk about Tar Baby by Toni Morrison. I'm pretty excited. I've never read a Toni Morrison book before, so I'm looking forward to it.
Looks like I'm going to go to my local library and pick up a copy to read before I listen to your episode in 2 weeks.
Yeah, thank you, Cleo. Yeah, go to your local library, pick up a copy and read it. And then, yeah, tune in and do the same thing with this episode. You can go back and listen to it on citr.ca/dog-eared, I think. But yeah, look out for this episode. Thank you again, Cleo, for joining me. Great episode.
Anytime.
Yeah, anytime. Well, you say that and you will be back. All right.
I mean, I already have another book suggestion, so I'll be ready.
Okay, perfect. Well, you can just stay on the line and then we can talk about it after. All right. listeners, I'm going to leave you there. So enjoy the rest of your Tuesday night.